It's a real privilege and pleasure to introduce the speaker today. He's been a friend of mine for many, many years, and in addition, he's an organic chemist, as I am, and he received part of his training at Harvard University, where I was educated. Dr. Julian was born in Alabama, and he went to DePauw for his undergraduate training, graduating in 1920 as valedictorian of his class. When he left DePauw, he went to Harvard and spent 3 or 4 years there, first learning how to do research and then as a research assistant, and took his master's degree from that institution. Following those years, he went to the West Virginia State Teachers College for Negroes and was professor for 1 year, then to Howard University in Washington as associate professor and acting head of the department for 2 years. Following that, he went to Vienna and completed his work with a doctor's degree, taking his research under a very distinguished alkaloid chemist, Professor Spaeth. Returning, he spent 1 year again at Howard as head of the department there of chemistry, and then came back to DePauw, his alma mater, where he remained for 4 years. Following that period, he was called to the Glidden Company, where the large soya division of that company, he was in charge of research, and continued that for many years, and then was given the added responsibility of the fine chemical work of that company. I think that I should say that during this period, he has published a long series, many dozens of scientific articles, has taken out many patents, and is recognized by the chemical profession all over this country and abroad. His achievements have not been merely in pure science, however, because the Glidden Company itself has progressed very rapidly since he took over their research. They had practically none when he went with the company, and now their achievements have been recognized by their competitors, and it has been due in large measure to our speaker. But along with all these activities, he's also been active in civic affairs. And I'll merely mention that he is on the Board of Trustees of Michael Reese Hospital of Roosevelt College and a member of numerous committees in Chicago of general civic interest. His achievements have been recognized. He has 6 honorary Doctor of Science degrees from Fisk, Howard, DePauw, Northeastern, West Virginia State Teachers College, and Northwestern University. In 1950, the Sun-Times selected him as the Chicagoan of the Year. He, in the next year, he was distinguished, he received the Distinguished Merit Award of the Decalogue Societies of Society of Lawyers in Chicago. And this last year, he was had the Distinguished Citizen Award at the Northwestern Centennial Celebration. I give you these things, a good many of them are known, but I'd like to add one or two other remarks on items which have led me to have a great respect for our speaker. It's often said that a teacher at in a small college cannot be expected to do any research because he has too much of a teaching load. And to a certain extent, that's true. It has always been my contention, however, that a man who really knows, is interested in research and has any ideas, will do research no matter where he is, no matter how heavy his teaching load is. And if you select distinguished chemists in the past, you will find that many of them started under the most adverse conditions before they finally arrived. Well, now, Dr. Julian is a good exemplification of what I've said, because he went to DePauw, from which very, very few scientific articles had been published in chemistry. And during that period of 4 years, He published a series of papers which would be a credit to any professor in any institution in this country or anywhere in the world. He succeeded finally in synthesizing a well-known and important alkaloid, physostigmine. That's one point. The other is this. The scientists are traditionally known to be poor writers and usually poor speakers. Dr. Julian is a man, however, one of those rare scientists who knows how to use the English language and who can write what he wishes to say, not only with an excellent vocabulary, but precisely and so that it is really readable. With these remarks, I'll present to you Dr. Percy L. Julian of the Glidden Company, who is not only a distinguished scientist, but industrial man and citizen in the United States. Dr. Julian.
Thank you, Dr. Adams. Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I couldn't help but think when Dr. Adams was talking of a story my mother told about me as a youngster very often. She said that one day when it was our wont as children to come home from Sunday school with a golden text, it was my particular day to bring it home. At the dinner table, we usually recited it. We were Methodists in those days, and the Methodists had this golden text in their Sunday school lessons. I had forgotten mine on that particular day, and my father waited for me at the dinner table, and he said, "Well, your turn." I couldn't remember it. I'd played by the wayside on the way home, and I began thinking, what was it? Devilish golden text. And I couldn't remember it. The father said, "Well," looked up from the table, and I knew I better start remembering pretty soon. Mother touched me and said, "That's all right, sonny, now just be calm. You'll remember. Just think now." And finally it came out, I said, "Oh, Mommy, I remember what it was." That the golden text that day had been, "It is I, O be not afraid, saith the Lord," from the book of Isaiah. And I said, "Oh, Mommy, I remember what it was. It was, don't be scared, it ain't nobody but me." sometime last year when some institution was giving me a, I believe it was Howard University, was giving me an honorary doctor's degree, there was a reception for two men, and the one of them was an eminent French scholar who addressed the evening banquet for the honorees. I happened to have a place on the program, too. He spoke first, and I felt pretty much like a small thimble trying to respond after that very brilliant address. This Monsieur le Docteur Bellegarde had asked them if he might have the privilege of speaking in his own language. And he spoke in French, and it was translated. It was beautiful French and beautiful oratory. So when I stood up, I asked them, told them that I would very much like the privilege of speaking in my own language. As Professor J.B.S. Haldane has written, our language doesn't lend itself to poetry. A ladybird, fly away home becomes impossible, he says, when you must call a ladybird coccinella dipunctata. And a primrose by the river's brim, a yellow primrose was to him, loses all of the flavor of Wordsworth when the primrose becomes a specimen of Primula vulgaris. Nevertheless, I'm here and I shall attempt to do my best. I've always felt a close kinship to the University of Illinois, as if I were a student here, had been a student here, although I've never been. Primarily for two reasons. Professor George Clark, professor of physical chemistry here, when he went to Vanderbilt, professor of analytical chemistry, I believe, when he went to Vanderbilt as professor of physical chemistry, I was a young assistant in chemistry down at Fisk University. Oh, we didn't have anything to read there in the way of a journal, and he courageously smuggled me into the library at Vanderbilt when in that day, in 1921, That was a very ticklish thing to do. So that I could sit there in the library for evenings after evenings and actually read and study, I will never forget Professor Clark for it. And then he came out and talked to my students at Fisk, and he encouraged me one way or the other, played a great part in my decision as to what I was going to try to do in life. Then years later, I was looking at the letter. I told Professor Adams I was looking at the letter yesterday. I was being considered for a position at the Glidden Company. And there was a very prominent man from Purdue University who was also being considered for the job. The only drawback to him was that that was in 1935. He had asked $18,000 a year for the job, which was pretty good money in those days. And they wondered what they could get me for, and they knew they could get me for just little or nothing, because I was looking for a job and knocking on some doors, trying to see which ones would open. And what turned the tide of the thing was a letter that Professor Adams, out of the goodness of his heart and out of the practice that he has maintained over years of encouraging young students of chemistry, going out of his way to do it, wrote. The chairman of the board looked at this letter, and he said, "Now, wait a minute here. You're thinking paying this man $18,000 and you're talking about what he can do and all like that. Listen to this letter from Professor Adams." And I'm going to quote from the letter because it's one of the things that was given to me later by DePauw University, and I prize the letter very highly. It's given to me really by the Glidden Company, because DePauw University sent it to the Glidden Company, and then the Glidden Company gave it to me, the original, for my files. And Professor Adams wrote that this young man's researches are on a par with any which are being published from institutions, our institutions in the United States. Now, that was to him just a feeling that he had. But to me, it meant the difference between where I am now and where I might have been but for the grace of God. And I always feel, therefore, a very tender relationship to your university for that reason. I'm told that a French translation of one of Paul's epistles to the Thessalonians carries the injunction, "Bear ye yourselves as faultless prophets." Our great teachers and religious leaders in America today cannot escape the role of prophets, for you are custodians, in a sense, of an image of hope and yearning, which hundreds of millions of people in this hour are attempting to bring into focus. That image of hope and yearning is represented by the American national character, and the whole world is attempting to discern its real and basic outline. Around this outline, the ferments of an entire world are today seething with mingling feelings of fear, of trembling, of yearning, of futility, of resignation, of despair, and of hope. The millions of surging humanity standing upon the brink of a new age are seeking a view of the image of our national character and what it portends for the future of civilization. There is no way in which we can reject the significant and history-making responsibilities inherent in this world situation. For no matter how comfortable to some of us may be our position, or may be the concept of our geographical position, as that of an island arsenal, the stark truth is that the social forces alone of a dawning new age have harnessed us to the remainder of the world in a geocentric system of appalling intimacies. To assume anything to the contrary is sheer nonsense. We are therefore approaching as a nation a peculiar and strategic rendezvous with the gracious God of human destiny, a crucial point of evolution in American history. For some of us are beginning to closet ourselves with our consciences and have a heart-to-heart talk. And gradually the American is being forced to put to himself the great historical question disturbing the remainder of the world. Who am I as an American?